international crystallographers. And crystallographers have classified their crystals and given them names. Well, actually, they're symbol names. They're not name names.
Okay.
And they're symbols and the various kinds of symmetry in those crystals. And Escher got a hold of one of their publications, and it fascinated him.
Hmm.
And that's when he started doing some of his symmetric drawings.
Okay. Okay, I can kind of see almost a crystal type pattern
In those, yeah. Uh-huh. So, now this particular one here, circle limit 3, when I first saw that, I said, that is the most beautiful example that I have ever seen of the Poincaré model for the hyperbolic plane.
Could you explain what that is?
And, yes. Little did I realize when I saw it that that's where Escher got his idea, was from the Poincaré model of the hyperbolic plane. The Poincaré model for the hyperbolic plane, hyperbolic geometry is a non-Euclidean geometry. We usually think of Euclidean geometry as the geometry of this earth or that we live in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Euclid did, was try to create his axioms to fit our world. Well, Euclid had a postulate, fifth postulate, was long and drawn out. It's called his parallel postulate. And everybody said, that should not be a postulate, that should be a theorem. You know the difference between postulates and theorems? A postulate is something you accept as a without proof.
Mm-hmm.
It's your basis for your reasoning, is a postulate. A theorem is something you prove from your accepted postulates or axioms.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, people thought Euclid's fifth postulate should not be a postulate, it should be a theorem. So they tried to prove it as a theorem. And in doing so, they end up with developing what we now call non-Euclidean geometry, or hyperbolic geometry is one of the non-Euclidean geometries. And Poincaré had a model. Lines were these curves, and points were points within this circle.
Mm-hmm.
And he developed his circle limit 3 from maybe there's a picture of it here. I think there's one in here somewhere. He got his idea anyway from Poincaré's model.
Okay.
I'm fairly certain there's one in here somewhere, but I don't see it right away in this book. Maybe if I look in the index under Coxeter, I'll find it. But Coxeter was the one that had a model. Poincaré model of the hyperbolic plane that Escher got a hold of. And Escher, it was triangles. Triangles got smaller and smaller as you go to the edge of the circle.
Uh-huh.
And so Escher put in these fish in those triangles.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Coxeter's talk at Syracuse University that night, he said, this point here in the center is no different than this point here. See, there's four fish wings come together here, mm-hmm. and four fish wings come together here. And I almost made a fool of myself and said, nah, that's not true. If I do a half turn about this point here, it maps into itself, But if I do a half turn about this point here where four fish wings come together, mm-hmm. it doesn't map into itself. So it can't be the same. Hmm. And as I was driving home, I said to myself, I'm thinking in the Euclidean sense, he's thinking in the hyperbolic sense, in hyperbolic geometry. He's not thinking in Euclidean geometry, so he's right.
Okay.
So if you do a half turn about this point here, it's the same as doing a half point by here. If you think hyperbolic rather than Euclidean.
Does hyperbolic have to take place within a circle?
Well, then? No, it doesn't.
Okay.
No, it doesn't. It's just that this is a model to fit the axioms.
Okay.
And there's more than one model that fits the axioms.
I see. Well, thank you for telling me about that. Could you talk a little more about being a professor at SUNY Oneonta? What did you do there?
I taught calculus. I taught. Always taught a geometry course because that's what they hired me for. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I teach two geometry courses, but always one geometry course. The only upper division courses I taught were geometry and modern algebra. Linear algebra, I taught upper division courses in linear algebra too. Abstract algebra, sometimes we call it. Mm-hmm. They needed some help in computers. Back in those days, computer science was in the math department. Mm. And so they needed some help in computer science. So I did teach a few computer science courses. Mostly programming.
Oh.
Programming in computer science fits mathematicians very well. They like code.
Mm-hmm.
I had a hard time going from DOS, which is disk operating system, which is all code, computer code, to Windows, which we all use now. Mm-hmm. I didn't have control. Using computer code, you have control over what happens. Mm-hmm. And when you go to Windows, you don't have that much control. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff, of course, and in fact, you can do marvelous things as time went on. Mm-hmm. But
so about what time were you using DOS?
When were we using DOS? In the 1980s?
Okay. Interesting.
I think I have my years right. Disk operating system.
So would you say that that's a way that the college evolved, shifting more towards computers while you were there?
Yes. When I taught programming languages, I always knew more than the students, and I could always do more than the students. But in Windows, sometimes the students knew more than I did.
Mm.
And they could do better at it than I could. So I didn't really care to teach Windows types courses. So I got out of computer science teaching when it became more Windows. I would still teach basic language or Pascal language, mm-hmm. or there's other languages came along, but by then I was out of computer science. Mm. So I always taught math.
Okay.
I've always teach math.
Was geometry your favorite type of math?
Yes, geometry was my favorite. I never got tired of geometry.
What In did all you my get years tired of?
Oh, I get tired of pre-calculus courses like trigonometry or algebra. I get tired of algebra. Mm-hmm. But I never got tired of geometry. I never got tired of calculus either, but anything below calculus, once in a while, I get tired of teaching.
What were some rewarding moments that you had while teaching?
Some rewarding moments. Mm-hmm. Studying M.C. Escher and giving talks on M.C. Escher at math conferences and publishing on M.C. Escher. Learning about him. I spent 15 years studying his life and what he did and so forth. And the highlight of my career was going to an M.C. Escher conference in Rome, Italy. Mm. I was invited to give a paper at the Italy conference. And you must know that the conference was not sponsored by the art department of the University of Rome. The conference was sponsored by the math department of the University of Rome.
Mm.
That shows you the math department's interest in M.C. Escher. The reason they had it in Rome is because Escher had spent some time in Rome.
Oh, okay.
When he graduated from college, let me backtrack just a little bit. He wanted to go to college and major in art. Mm-hmm. And his father thought that art was a waste of time. That was a useless thing to major in. So they had an agreement that he would major in architecture. Well, when he got to college, he really majored in art, not architecture. M.C. Escher, that is. And after his graduated from college, he and his friends took a trip to Italy. And they went all over Italy. And all his friends ran out of the money within a week. But Escher seemed to have some kind of an inheritance. I don't know where he got it. Parents from his grandparents or somewhere. Had some money to stay. And he did landscaping. Now, if Escher would have stayed with landscaping, he never would have become a famous artist. But because he diverted to symmetries, impossible figures, things that change as you look at the pictures, change as you look at them from convex to concave, or as you go around the figure, maybe things look in and then they look out.
Mm-hmm.
And so impossible objects that he created, which fascinates people, mostly college students, to this day.
That's very true. So how did your life change once you retired after working so hard on Escher?
I changed my emphasis of research to a Mormon history after I retired.
Okay.
So since I had my retirement, I've been retired now 8 years. I've spent all my time on Mormon history, doing research in Mormon history, mainly along the Susquehanna River. Joseph Smith was married in Afton, New York, which is only about 45 minutes from here.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked for two farmers down there. And he met his wife in Pennsylvania. We just crossed the border into Pennsylvania. And so that has interests to me. I feel like I'm the authority on Susquehanna River church history.
Could you give me a little background on your religion? I'm not too familiar with.
The Latter-day Saint religion?
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Smith, Palmyra, New York, was in Palmyra, living in Palmyra, New York, and he was a young man, and there was a lot of religious revivals going on in the area. Palmyra's up near Rochester, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so he read from the Bible. His family were Bible reading people. In James, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And he says, well, I lack wisdom. I don't know which of all these various religions I should join. His mother joined the Presbyterians, and he kind of favored the Methodists. So he went into a grove of trees to pray, and he received a vision that he was not to join any of the churches of that day, that he was to present a new religion, mm-hmm. which ended up being the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mormon is just a nickname
mm-hmm.
for that church.
Okay.
And then in Ohio, they were having a lot of success with converts in the Cleveland area. And so because the Smith family lost their home in Palmyra because they missed a payment, a mortgage payment, mm-hmm. they were out actually seeking work and so forth, and they were they moved to Kirtland, Ohio, which is near Cleveland, Ohio, and that's where the headquarters of the church was. The church was originally organized in Fayette, New York, which is up in the Finger Lakes region of New York. Mm-hmm. And then they went to Missouri and finally to Nauvoo, Illinois. And the Mormons formed a community in Nauvoo, Illinois, which became as large as Chicago at the time. Mm. And they had made a mistake of voting the same as a block. And because they were the dominant numbers in that part of Illinois, they controlled the elections because they voted as a block.
Oh.
And then they would be with the Whigs one time and the, I forgot who the other party was, the Republicans or the Democrats another time. They didn't do too well. Mm-hmm. They were not well liked, and so they were driven out of, and that's when they were. Joseph Smith was killed.
Oh.
He was killed. They took him in jail. They jailed him, mm-hmm. and then a mob stormed the jail, and he was killed. And that's when Brigham Young took over the leadership of the church, and they went to Salt Lake City.
Okay.
And the reason they went to Salt Lake City was a place no one lived or no mm-hmm. one wanted. There was a man by the name of Sam Brannan who took a boat of Latter-day Saints from New York City all the way around the end of South America and back into San Francisco. And he went and met Brigham Young in Wyoming. They hadn't gotten to Salt Lake City yet. And he tried to talk Brigham Young into coming to California. He thought California was the place to be. Hmm. And Brigham Young said, no, we need to be where no one else is and wants. So that's why they settled in Salt Lake City. And Sam Brannan went back to California and he became the California's first millionaire.
Oh.
He made his money on railroads. He and hotels. He sold. He didn't mine gold. Mm-hmm. He made his money in the gold rush times. He bought the gold. He sold the miners whiskey and supplies. And he had hotels and places to house them. Mm-hmm. So he did very well, and he ended up having railroads. Well, Sam Brannan's big fault was he liked women and whiskey, which is both against our religion.
Oh, no.
And his wife divorced him, and she demanded half of what he owned in cash. Mm. And that ruined him, because what he owned was not cash, but railroads and hotels and... And there's a place in California called, if I can think of the name of it, he was going to call it Saratoga of California. He was trying to imitate Saratoga, New York.
Okay.
As a resort place. Mm-hmm. And he was drinking and he slurred his words and said, Calistoga or something like that. Anyway, so that the name of that town is that today. He ran a railroad up to that. There's some hot springs there. Mm-hmm. In and I visited the place, and of course the historical museum there has all about Sam Brandon.
So what was your goal in traveling to these different sites?
Which sites are you referring to? I mean,
any of the Mormon sites.
Oh, any of the Mormon sites. Mm-hmm. Well, history has always been, I've always been a history buff. Mm-hmm. So I try to learn the history behind them and visit them.
Does it give you a deeper connection to your religion to see where these things happen?
I think it does, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, in what order did you go to different places?
Well, when I moved here to New York, of course, Mormonism started up in Palmyra, New York, so I visited that right away. Harmony, Pennsylvania, near Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, is where Joseph Smith lived and translated the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. So that was of interest to me. And then I learned about after New Yorker was married and Josiah Stoll, who Joseph Smith worked for, and Joseph Knight, who he worked for. I learned about them later, actually within probably the last 15 years, mm-hmm. Where their homes were and their farms were. I learned them most recently. Joseph Smith convinced Joseph Knight and Josiah Stoll that he was to receive the plates for the Book of Mormon, and they were up in Palmyra the day before he was to receive the plates. Joseph Smith was not given the plates. He had to meet the angel at the Hill Cumorah at the same time as September 27th, I believe it was, for 4 years before he was to receive the plates. I guess he had to prove himself that he was worthy of such a task of translation.
Hmm. Did you say you also went to Nauvoo?
Yes, my wife and I served a mission to Nauvoo. 2005-2006. Now, Nauvoo is a little bit like Farmer's Museum in Cooperstown. Mm-hmm. It's they have a blacksmith shop and a brickyard, and Joseph Smith's home is there. Brigham Young's home is there. John Taylor's home, who was the third president of our church, is there. Heber C. Kimball home was there. He was a counselor to Brigham Young, mm-hmm. in the first presidency of the church. I worked in the blacksmith shop there. I wasn't very good at it, but I did hammer a few pieces of metal to demonstrate for the people. Look up there. Mm-hmm. I worked in the brickyard, and we'd make brick. Little sample bricks to give people. Mm-hmm. We would, well, back in those days, they had a kiln that they built, but we had a kiln of today, mm-hmm. Like they do an oven, I guess you call it. I worked in the Jonathan Browning gun shop. Now, the Browning guns, the automatic rifles and all the automatic machine guns and so forth that were invented by his son, John Moses Browning. Mm-hmm. John Moses Browning was born in Ogden, Utah.
Oh, okay.
And his father joined the Mormon Church, mm-hmm. In Illinois and moved to Nauvoo and had a gun shop there in Nauvoo. Now, Jonathan Browning in Nauvoo, this is before the day of bullets. John Moses Browning, who was born in Ogden, Utah, his automatic guns had bullets like we have today. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to work in the Jonathan Browning gun shop and demonstrate And he was really a blacksmith. And he made his guns by old-fashioned blacksmith methods.
Mm.
And so we demonstrate, we didn't actually do it, but we would demonstrate what he did. Mm-hmm. We had samples there of what he did. They had a tin shop in Nauvoo. We didn't actually make tin items, but we had tin items there to demonstrate with that mm-hmm. were made somewhere else. But that's what Nauvoo is a place a little bit like Farmer's Museum in Cooperstown, except there's a religious side of it too.
Okay. So are all of those buildings, were they placed together, or were they originally set
They're the same places they were when the saints were in Nauvoo.
Okay.
The Brigham Young home has been restored.
Mm-hmm.
They had some, place in Virginia, the historical place in Virginia.
Williamsburg,
yeah. They had some of the architects from Williamsburg come there to Nauvoo and do some of the archaeological diggings mm-hmm. to find out where the outhouse was, to say Brigham Young's. When we went to, first time I went to Nauvoo, they were doing archaeological diggings, you know, where they do the trenches and so forth,
mm-hmm.
find out where the outhouse was, and then they built an outhouse there. They found out where the cistern was, and they put a cistern there. They have a root cellar, found out where that was, and they put a root cellar there, because most the Brigham Young's home was still there,
mm-hmm.
But it had been added to.
Oh, okay.
Since Brigham Young lived there. So what they did, they tore off the new parts and made it back to where it was when Brigham Young lived there.
Mm-hmm. What did they find in the archaeological digs? Any small artifacts or anything?
Well, they would find the china that was in the outhouse or wherever they put it.
Mm-hmm.
When they broke china, and then they would buy china of that make and put it in the Brigham Young home.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And other homes, too.
Did you say that your wife went with you on the trip?
Yes, we were together.
Okay.
This is after we retired.
Okay. And what did she do while in Nauvoo?
Same thing I did. Well, she didn't work in the Brown and Gun shop, but she worked in the Brigham Young home. Do tours of the Brigham Young home.
Okay.
The Women's Relief Society was organized there, and she would give tours of that.
Mm-hmm.
There were some sites we would call men's sites, and some sites were women's sites. the Browning Gun Shop was very popular for the men.
Mm-hmm.
And the homes were usually where the women gave the tours.
Okay. That makes sense. So, what else have you done as a retired person?
I have got interested in what I call CCAL, C-C-A-L. That stands for Center for Continuing Adult Learning. I am now the treasurer of that organization. Mm-hmm. We hold courses, offer courses at Oneonta State and Harwood College here in Oneonta. Courses of everything, poetry, Shakespeare, history courses of all types. I've given a course on Escher, M.C. Escher. I've given a course, I was requested to give a course on fractals. Fractal is something that's self-similar. What are some example of something that is self-similar? Many trees grow in a self-similar pattern. The branches of the trees grow that way. If you look at one branch, it's similar to another branch, except maybe larger.
Mm-hmm.
And similar, it doesn't have to be the same shape, but not necessarily the same size to be So fractals, there's fractal geometry too. It's computer generated geometry.